Hello and welcome to our University of Strathclyde podcast series, run out of the world-famous School of Education, right in the heart of the beautiful city of Glasgow in Scotland. We bring you a mix of meeting academic interviews, thought pieces, conversations and provocations on all things education, to give you a glimpse into our world-leading education research here at Strathclyde, and of course to stimulate your questions and thinking around the meaning, purpose and practice of education. In schools, in communities, and of course in all our lives.
Hello everybody. Welcome to the Strathclyde University School of Education podcast. I'm Maria Ivancheva, and today we'll be speaking with a visiting academic that we had at our school over the last couple of years, in fact, E.M. Eisen-Markowitz. Hello, E.M.
Hi.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself? Some of our colleagues know you and some don't, because we were online the whole last year that you were with us.
Yeah, that's true. Hi, everyone. My name is E.M. I consider myself a teacher and a facilitator first and foremost. And all of my research and learning is based on trying to understand history and identity and contemporary realities. I'm a genderqueer woman, a white Jewish person, entering middle age. I'm from big cities across or along the East Coast of the United States, though my family history is that we haven't really been in one place for more than a generation. Right now, I live outside of Boston, Massachusetts, in a city that is called Malden. But until June of 2021, I lived and taught high school social studies in New York City. I've been a school-based educator since 2006. I worked first in Massachusetts and then for 13 years in New York as a teacher, a union chapter delegate, a gender and sexuality alliance facilitator, a restorative justice coordinator. And mostly I worked at schools that in the US are often called alternative schools, which is a secondary school that's serving students who are older, so ages 16 to 22, which is definitely older for most traditional schools in the United States and also in Scotland. I also have a lot of interests outside of school. Mm-hmm. You mentioned those.
Maybe briefly.
Yeah. Okay. I like swimming. I cook and bake, I read a lot, and I also help curate a collaborative art presence on social media that is called Vent_diagrams, which is a play on words.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe you tell us a bit about that later. So how did you come to the University of Strathclyde School of Education?
Yeah, so I first came to Glasgow in January of 2020. On a U.S. government grant that is called a Fulbright Award, to learn more about what it means when Scotland says that it's, quote, a world leader in LGBT inclusive education. And I came specifically to Strathclyde because your School of Education educates such a large percent of the country's teachers. I think at the time, if I remember, it was like 82% of the country's teachers. And also, of course, because Professor Yvette Taylor was here, who I had been connected to through the Fulbright program. In case, I don't know if I should say anything about what the Fulbright program is. I'm not sure. A lot of people that I met, even academics in Scotland, didn't know very much about Fulbright.
So just maybe again, like very briefly for people to know. And some might be interested to do the exchange.
Yeah. So Fulbright is an American scholarship program that was started amidst the like sort of nationalism and quote goodwill following the Second World War in 1946 to allow for like people-to-people ambassadors. In the United States, like most people know about the Fulbright program. It's very well known, but it actually works the other way too. US scholars and teachers go to many countries around the United States, and UK scholars are invited also to come to US. Scholars and researchers from the UK can do Fulbright scholarships at United States universities. So in fact, Professor Taylor had done a Fulbright at a university in the United States about a decade ago. Yeah, I'll say specifically that as many people may know, that in 2018, the Scottish government accepted recommendations of a working group that was called the Time for Inclusive Education, or the TIE campaign. And that policy allegedly required the teaching of LGBTI history and literature at every grade level in Scotland, at every school in Scotland. And at the time, the education ministers said there will be no exemptions or opt-outs to this policy, which will embed LGBTI inclusive education across the curriculum and across subjects, and which the Scottish government believes is a world first. So I came specifically to Scotland and to Glasgow and to Strathclyde because I wanted to know, like, what does this actually mean to queer people who are at Scottish schools? And also, is inclusion even the goal?
So before we go to that, like, just a short detour, perhaps, like, it would be interesting to know, you were a Fulbright scholar during the pandemic, and that's a strange time to be present and absent in the same time, online, offline. How was your research and fellowship impacted by this quite unique situation? Was there anything you needed to do to adapt your research and life plans around it?
Yes, of course. there was so much that changed. I had a unique experience because I first was in Glasgow from January to March of 2020. And actually very quickly, I met a lot of people and got into a lot of schools. Like, when I talked to my colleagues who were sort of on the same number of months, who are Fulbright scholars, even in other parts of the UK, they hadn't met very many people. And the reason that I was able to meet so many people is because queer teachers want to meet other queer teachers. I basically showed up in person to a gathering of queer identified teachers at a bookstore, and then was very quickly connected to the LGBT caucus in the union. And so I met a lot of queer people in person really quickly. And people invited me to their schools, people met up with me outside of school. And yeah, then I was required to come home. My visa was ended and in mid-March of 2020. And some of those relationships I was able to maintain virtually. And when I came back, I just had no idea. It was earlier this year in 2022. I just had no idea how much in-person connection I was going to be able to maintain. But it was, I will say that those relationships, those individual relationships with people that I met in 2020, were a lot of them were able to sustain virtually or via text or Zoom. And ultimately, I was able to go in person to some of those places, but I could do no observations. Like, unless I was being invited by an individual teacher to come into their class or to their sphere of influence in their school, I could not get into schools. There was not a official channel for that. And so the work that I was doing really could not be interview-based or observation-based in the same way that I had intended. Mm-hmm. And I will also say that my feelings and opinions about schools and schooling was deeply shifted because of the pandemic. And so ultimately, I'm not sad that I didn't get to do a more traditional, what I imagined was going to be more of a traditional interview process that resulted in some recommendations or some best practices. No, I didn't end up doing that at all. I wasn't able to. And I'm actually really glad because I feel deeply skeptical of best practices in this area of schools and schooling. So ultimately I'm grateful for the shifts that in this way,
can you elaborate a bit on that? How did they shift your opinions and feelings about schools and schooling during the pandemic?
I mean, I think I always knew that part of the reason I got into teaching, a large part of the reason that I got into teaching, is because, first of all, I just really enjoy young people. I really enjoy being around young people. But the other reason is because I think schools can be a lever to change society. And I think schools need to change. So I always knew that. That was always my lens. But in the last couple of years, I think that there's more dismantling that needs to happen than shifts within individual school buildings. I think that shifts within individual school buildings can be harm reduction, can reduce harm between individuals, or even some policies can shift slightly. But I think that there's such a disconnect between policy, including this one that I came to study for, and the experiences of people at schools, that it feels almost irresponsible to give a set of best practices that individual people can enact in a school building. I'm much more interested in either learning ultimately what this project ended up being, sort of learning about what are queer people doing for themselves and one another already in the schools. So looking at the realities right now, and then thinking about how there can be much wider scale change that I can't quite imagine. The problems and the depth of how wrong schools are and how much damage schools do was so obvious during the pandemic, and how many social services are accessed through schools without that being an acknowledgement. There just was so many things that came up for me that it's very unsettling to participate in something that felt reformist.
I understand. So your research is on the queer brackets at school archive. Can you tell us a bit more about what is this archive? What is its history? Who is it for? And how does it connect to this disconnect between policy and practice in schools, perhaps?
Yeah, I think I want to start by saying that I think a major limitation of the work and of the Queer at School archive is that it should be collaborative. My inclination is towards collaboration always, but it hasn't really been that way so far. The Fulbright Award and that structure is very individual. And as we've just said, it was during the pandemic, and even the queer teachers in Scotland that I've made what I believe will be lifelong connections and relationships with, everyone's lives are in crisis, really and truly. It's hard to ask people to, collaboration is deep, meaningful collaboration is slow, and it is not happening with the Queer at School archive yet. Mm-hmm. But I will say, so in May of this year, after talking to a bunch of folks, reconnecting with people when I came back, including some individuals in Scotland and across the UK who have been involved in other kinds of queer archives, I started the Queer at School archive, and it's a digital catalog of survival, joy, and connection from and for queer, gender nonconforming, and non-binary students, educators, and parents and carers in Scotland. It's a website, it's an Instagram account. It displays stories, artifacts, and objects that are submitted by a range of queer individuals who are either currently at or have been at Scottish primary and secondary schools. And the prompts that they were offered were about ways that they make it through the day, celebrate themselves and one another, or resist hetero and cis normativity, and or experience joy at school.
Can you elaborate a bit on what kind of stories there are, like who submitted, you know, in a way, like, I was interested, how do you study the archive, but you both make it, you know, you co-create it, I imagine, and you study it. So it's quite an interesting practice for researchers to even try to picture how it works for you and how do you work within it.
Yeah. So far, it's purposefully sort of shifting and open sourced. It's for people to individually self-identify and to determine how whatever they've submitted fits with the prompts. So the purpose of it is to find out how do individuals respond to these prompts. And it's much more open-ended than other kinds of research that I've done in the past. And honestly, it's anonymous. So I don't know all the time who has submitted. It's just how people are self-identifying. So maybe there's somebody that I met at an event and then asked them to contribute, but I don't know if they are. I can guess based on, you know, some identifying information. So far, most of the people who have submitted are alumni. So young adults who have graduated from secondary schools in Scotland. Or their educators, current and former educators. That's so far. And if you look at the archive, there's a section where people self-identify in terms of sort of like identity markers, gender, sexuality, race, class, religion, however people want to identify themselves. And then they are sharing photos or screenshots. There's some email screenshots that people have shared, pieces of curricula, notes or cards that people have received. There's a couple of sort of hand-drawn maps of schools. So there's a variety of different kinds of materials that people are offering to the archive.
Mm-hmm. But so maybe it's kind of the academic output orientedness, but is the archive the output itself, or what kind of reflection or post-production do you do with whatever is submitted beyond curating the site as a collection?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I don't know yet. I'm struggling a little bit. Like now I'm back in the United States and I'm working full time in schools again. I don't have the time and the spaciousness that I did in Glasgow to work on this. But it's an ongoing project, and I'm not entirely sure what I want to come out of it. I can imagine a lot of things, but I also want it to be an output in itself so that it is available to anyone. Like, it's very important to me for it to be ongoing, ever shifting, open sourced, and anonymous, so that anyone anywhere can use it for their, can use it to develop curriculum, to start conversations, to bring to, policymakers, to feel connected to one another. Like, I want it to be something that is useful and usable to other people in addition to whatever I or my collaborators decide to do mm-hmm. with it.
And then a follow-up question, which is, and I think it connects a bit to your question around schools and policy and the disconnect between policy and practice. So schools are seen, there's always this tension in schools between being a tool for reproduction of the system and a tool of resistance against the system. And it's probably both in some combination in each and every school. And an archive is a very similar tool. It has been criticized as something that tries to classify experience and by this produce some level of at least violence, you know, colonial or imperial, patriarchal, you know, whatever, trying to order things. But it also has been used very counter-hegemonically, including in the case of queer ed school, to produce counter-narratives against domination. So I'm just kind of curious, what's your experience and also maybe prediction about the possibilities of something like the Queer at School Archive or other similar grassroots collections? What possibilities do they hold? And to what extent then the school and the archive can be a queer space?
Yeah, I think maybe I'm going to start with the second question that you offered. I appreciate the framing, and I think most any tool can be used in a lot of different ways, sometimes in many ways at once, in terms of reproducing or even enacting violence and also resisting. So I appreciate the framing. I think for me, part of the reason that I named this the Queer at School Archive is because I don't think, it's obviously much easier to just call it a queer school archive, but that's wrong. That's not true. It isn't a queer school. I don't think schools right now, in fact, I think schools everywhere are almost always really normative places where dominant social expectations are reproduced through very slow to change systems. But there are queer people at every school, at every single school. So we're already here. We're already queer at school, even if the schools are not and may never be like queer spaces. So I think the Queer at School Archive is intending to reckon with those sort of contradictory truths, right? Is the realities of to sort of name that the realities is that schools and perhaps archives have inherent limitations to the structures, and that there are people who are already living our lives in ways that are in opposition or resistant to the structures that schools are trying to reproduce. So the purpose of this archive right now, it is not actually really curated or sorted or tagged or coded at all. Right now it's small. Ultimately, perhaps it will be helpful for that to be the case, but I would like some collaborators to determine what that might look like. Other queer folks who are in or have been in primary and secondary schools. All of the exact word for word submissions are there on the site right now, which doesn't necessarily mean that that's like inherently a counter narrative. In fact, I think there's another limitation that you didn't quite mention is that right now each individual entry represents an individual and their perspective. Like sometimes when I read them, I'm like, I don't personally agree with that. I don't even see that as resisting cis heteronormativity, you know? So there's no common definitions that we're all working from, common language. It's just completely open sourced. And so perhaps that is, there are some potential dangers there too. But so are there dangers from me as a researcher, as a curator of this archive, deciding based on my perspective, individually, unilaterally, this is appropriate for the archive and this is not. So right now, it continues to be open sourced and anonymous in that way. Mm-hmm. I think I'll pause there.
Yeah. So you know, and we can maybe revisit this in a few years and see where it's developed. So it's interesting, you know, like coming back to the question of schools. You're a teacher and a teacher with a focus on social sciences and social justice. So can you speak now more about the actual experience of schooling and schooling in the US and Scotland? And what did you find? You know, like what is a socially just school? What prevents it to be so? And, you know, and perhaps it is kind of interesting because some of our, we did have a discussion more recently at the school and we are trying to have an input about policy in Scotland and, you know, where are the future of schools lie. And we are dealing with the tension between, oh, Scotland is so cool and we're doing the greatest stuff. And then also a sort of maybe parochialism and, you know, quite a lot of navel-gazing about what Scotland is without much meaningful comparison outside. So it's interesting to kind of see a perspective of somebody that is already an insider and outsider to the Scottish schooling system as yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually what I found is that at least my experiences, I don't know if I can answer that question broadly or make generalizations, but I can say that in my experiences, connecting specifically with other, like the only people that I spoke to in Scotland, besides people that I was meeting sort of in my day-to-day life, but people that I was connecting with deeply were people who were self-identified as queer and social justice oriented. Like that's all I met in Scotland, which is obviously not all I know in the United States. So my perspective and my experiences are very limited in that because of how I was connected with folks in Scotland. But I will say that in terms of both in terms of connecting at schools and with queer teachers, students, parents in the like places that I've lived for the longest time in the United States and in Glasgow. So New York City, Boston, and Glasgow are actually remarkably culturally similar. And in some of the ways that you're talking about, where all three of those places love to self-congratulate. Like I think that there's navel gazing, but even, you know, outside of the academy and outside of schools, there's a lot of sort of self-congratulatory liberalism in a context of a very intense, violent empire. And so there's in both places. So, you know, it's interesting. I would say that my experiences as a queer person who's mostly lived in like large, diverse and divided Western cities, actually, you know, Glasgow was very familiar to me in that way, and the University of Strathclyde. So there were a lot of similarities, and there are a lot of similarities to think about how differences within Scotland or differences within the United States from those major cities that I've just shared about a lot of those patterns show up too. So, and of course, that in both places, there's powerful and connected movements and legacies of questioning these like stratified and rigidly oppressive systems. So I think for me, I'll just say that though, that actually I was struck by the similarities and by like, you know, even just my getting around in Glasgow, I was like, oh, this is like getting around in Boston or getting around in New York City. Whereas some of my, you know, some of the other Fulbright scholars who came to the UK, that there was one other person in Glasgow who was a much younger person and was working on a totally different project, but she's from a small town in Florida. And the reality was that, and she was like, wow, Glasgow is so different from the United States. And I was like, actually, Glasgow's different from your small town in Florida, which is really different. And in some ways, culturally, it was more familiar for me as a person who's lived my entire life in the United States to be in Glasgow than it might have been for me to be in a small town in Florida.
Yeah. So what is next for the Queer at School archive? And what is next for you, Ian?
Well, as I sort of alluded to before, I think what happens next with the archive is really centered on three questions that I don't yet have the answer to. The first one is, with whom and how will I collaborate on this archive? The second one is, how should this archive expand beyond Scotland? Should it? And the third one is, will queer people at schools find this archive useful and meaningful? And how can it be more so? And I don't really know yet. I don't know the answers to those questions, and I don't have a clear plan in this moment about how to answer those questions, primarily because I personally just don't have the space or the time or the money to return to this in the meaningful ways that I'd like to. So I think right now it's sort of on hold, even though submissions are open. And there have been a couple of people who contributed to the archive just through the website and through the Instagram account. But I think for me, maybe this is back to your question earlier about archives in general, I really believe that in order to reimagine how we might organize ourselves differently in society and in schools, we have to hear directly from queer people at schools. And there just isn't in Scotland or in the United States, there isn't really a way to do that that is sustainable and that isn't filtered through the like lens of like best practices. And I hope that the Queer at School archive, with collaboration and expansion, can be a flexible and sustaining portal for hearing directly from queer people at schools.
Great. So just to finish off, where do people find the Queer archive? Where do they find you? And where do they find Venn diagrams?
Okay. Well, the easiest one is the archive is at www.queerschoolarchive.com. And you can actually reach everything else there as well. On Instagram, it's at Queer School Archive. I don't have a personal, but there's honestly, it's too much for me to keep up with the personal and the professional accounts. I don't have a public personal social media account, but Vent Diagrams is also on Instagram at vent_diagrams. And my contact information to email is also through the site at queerschoolarchive.com.
So we will link these diagrams in the show notes.
And great.
Thank you very much for the interview, and hopefully we'll see you soon back in Glasgow.
Yeah, and if anybody is interested in collaborating with me, please, please do reach out. I would love that. And I do hope to be back and to meet you in person sometime.
Yeah. Goodbye, Ian. See you soon, hopefully.
See you soon. Be well.
Thank you for listening in to our Strathclyde Education Podcast Series. We'll be back soon with another episode.